I'll start. The talk will be divided in two parts. The first part will be an introductory part. I'll start talking briefly about integrable systems. This will hopefully motivate the introduction of 4D Chern-Simons theory. And hopefully this will motivate the introduction of 6D Chern-Simons theory on twister space. So that will be the first part, an introductory part. The second part will be based on this paper, which is integrable deformations from twister space. Please ask. Yeah?
Just
light?
There's this thing over there.
Yeah.
The other way.
Yeah, the back. Is this all lecture presents in the DB lecture?
Yeah.
That was on lecture.
Okay. I can try and write a stronger. Bueno, please, any questions you have, please. This is better or worse?
Oh, I thought it was declared. That was the issue. What was the issue?
Let's see. Well, if something is unreadable, I can. No, but not.
It's the best I can.
Okay, there we go. Okay, so integrable systems. In this talk, I will focus on classical integrability. I will make some comments on quantum integrability, or very small ones. So, integral systems are systems that have a large number of symmetries, which usually implies Pianeder's theorem, a large number of conserved charges. And whenever we have a system with so many constrained charges, so many conserved charges, this imposes a large number of constraints. And this sometimes leads to exact solvability. This part is what makes integrable models, integrable systems so special. That's why people study them and care about them. But there is a caveat to integrable systems, which is that given a system or a theory, it's very difficult a priori to know whether that theory, that system, is integrable or not. It's very difficult to find, if no one tells you how, to find this large number of symmetries and then follow this path to get here. So throughout the years, people have addressed these questions, have looked at this question, and with time, people came up with a sort of very schematic statement, which is, say one has a theory with some action S over some manifold M with some group valued fields. And the statement is very schematically goes like, if the equations of motion for this action, again, this is classical integrability, are equivalent to some flatness equation for some connection A built in terms of the fields of this theory, then broadly speaking, one can attain integrability. So I give a couple of examples. So in 2D, the name of that connection there is called the Lax connection. So say one has some theory on some manifold, two-dimensional manifold with coordinates t and x, and one looks for the Lax connection, which is a connection, as I said, built in terms of these fields of the theory. But which also depend on some additional parameter called the spectral parameter, which is valued in the Riemann sphere. And the claim is, as I wrote there, there is a little caveat to this, but to make the argument, if the equations of motion for S are equivalent to a flatness of L, and this is true for every set, then I'll write S is Lax integrable. The caveat is that, well, the charges one construct has to be in involution, but again, let's use this idea. So similarly, there is a similar statement for theories in four dimensions. So one looks for, again, say you have a theory on R4, and one looks for a connection A which satisfies the anti-self dual Young-Mills equations. So F equals minus star F. So you might wonder, this is not quite a flatness for A, but this is, secretly it is, but not for this A, and this is due to the Penrose-Ward correspondence, which identifies holomorphic vector bundles on twister space with solutions to the anti-self dual Young-Mills equations. In particular, for a vector bundle to be holomorphic, what we need is that the anti-holomorphic leg of the connection is integrable. And of course, this implies flatness of the connection of this bundle. So secretly, this condition here is also a flatness equation. So this is very nice. People managed to translate the problem of finding symmetries in systems to flatness of connections. The problem is, how do I actually construct these connections? Nobody tells you, at least until some years ago, nobody told you how to construct these connections. And so a couple of people had a very nice idea. Yes?
There's a third board, if you just pull that up.
Okay.
Well, you can use it.
Thanks. So, a very nice idea to address what I was saying, and this was due to Kevin Costello here, Yamasaki, and I will also write Witten just in case. So they wrote three papers. I'm going to mainly focus on the third one, who Witten didn't participate, but I didn't want to risk not to write his name, just in case. And so I'm not sure how they did have this idea, but I imagine then talking and saying like, oh, where can we find connections in physics? And they said, oh, well, you can find connections in gauge theories. So the fields of gauge theories are connections. So these are great candidates to construct this sort of structure. And in particular, there is a very nice gauge theory which is Chern-Simons theory. I write R3 here to make it simple, whose equations of motion are precisely flatness for A. Now, the issue with this is that we are looking for fields which are, first of all, this is in three dimensions. We are looking for fields, if we want a 2D integral field theory, in two dimensions. And we don't want our field to be a gauge field. We want our field to be a common group-valued field. And so the very nice insight, the beautiful idea in that appear in this paper was, OK, say we have R3, and this is this. Let us complexify and compactify one of the real direction. And so thanks. It's one third with what, with a commutator. Yeah. So it would be a one and so they said, okay. This is a three form. We are now working on a 4D manifold. We have to insert something here for this integral to make sense. Let us insert a one form. But this is not any one form, but instead, this is what they, I think they called a disorder operator. And this disorder operator will be a meromorphic one form along a meromorphic one form along the CP1 direction. So for example, omega can be dz over z, where z is the CP1 coordinate. So what does this do schematically? So we have CP1 times R2. And we have introduced poles. So this guy here has a pole at 0, a pole at infinity. And by introducing these poles, what we are effectively doing is we are putting a boundary to a manifold that didn't have a boundary before. And so we have a gauge theory in a manifold which now has a boundary. And this boundary will partially break the gauge symmetry of this theory. And when you break the gauge symmetry, this induces fields living in the boundary, known sometimes as edge modes in the literature. And so the idea was, OK, what happens if we study the dynamics of these boundary fields living on the boundary, which is a copy of R2 at each of the poles, which is the kind of thing we are looking for in a 2D IFT. And notably, to go from here to here, the equations of motion of this four-dimensional theory are conveniently inherited to this two-dimensional theory in the sense that the equations of motion there are a flatness for a connection. So this, I don't know how they thought about this idea, but this is the way I understand it. And in particular, there are two objects in this theory, which are omega and boundary conditions. Why I say boundary conditions, given that we have now put a boundary to our theory, we will have to put boundary conditions on our gauge fields. And the beautiful thing about this is that you can change omega. Namely, you can choose different poles, put them in different places. You can change the order of the poles. And you can change the boundary conditions. And by changing all of that, what you obtain here is different. In particular, this theory here with input data, this is a machine to construct systematically 2D integral field theories. So this came out, the interoperability community went crazy and started pulling the handle and constructing 2D theories, 2D theories, 2D theories. Many of them were already known, and so they were like, oh, very nice, we can construct theories we already know from this theory. There were also some theories which were not known, and people found a way to construct them. And in 2020, so this was 2019, and people continue to work on this theory and to produce these 2D IFTs. There are other things you can change. You can change CP1 by heterogeneous surfaces, and this leads to even more new, different stuff. But in 2020, another paper comes out, which again, I don't know the story, because in the paper they say that they heard a very inspiring talk also by Kevin, and I don't know who was in that talk, but either Roland Bittlestone or David Skinner or both were there. But in 2020, so Roland here and David Skinner publish a very interesting paper in which they say, okay, people have been working on this. Nah, I can do this. And this is done by introducing disorder operators. But thinking about this here, specifically this here, they said, do we know a theory? Again, I don't know how did they thought, but do we know a theory such that its equations of motion are this? And the answer is yes. And the theory is Chern-Simons theory in six dimensions. So I will write here on twister space, Euclidean twister space. So there is a caveat here, which is that the holomorphic Chern-Simons theory in six dimensions, as it was introduced by Witten, as it was, couldn't be defined on twister space because twister space is not Calabi-Yau. I'll go back to this when I actually write this action. But they said, okay, if you can put poles here, maybe we can also put poles in the form appearing in 6D Chern-Simons theory. And that allows to have a well-defined action. And if we put poles to this manifold here, we are conceptually doing exactly the same thing that we're doing here. Instead of here having R2, we would have R4. And so hopefully this will also induce a theory on R4. And in particular, by doing the same procedure, they constructed indeed four-dimensional theories from this, and the equations of motion are, as expected, anti-self-dual Young-Mills. Now, people have studied this for a long time. People have known for a long time that you can construct two-dimensional integral models from 4D anti-self-dual Young-Mills equations through a procedure known as symmetry reduction. And so this drawing here begs the question if we can also do this and close this diamond. So schematically, symmetry reduction is we have a theory in R4. Let us pick two directions of the R4, kill them to obtain a theory in R2. So what happens if we pick the same two directions in this R4? And kill them, do we obtain a 4D Chern-Simons theory that we can afterwards bring to the 2D IFT in a way in which this diagram commutes? Namely, can we first, I usually say localize, but then Kevin, who invented this, said he likes better compactify. So I say first compactify and then symmetry reduce, or first symmetry reduce and then compactify, do we get to the same theory? And the answer is yes, we do. Furthermore, in 2021, Kevin again publishes a paper in which he shows that field theories coming from local actions on twister space are subject to be quantized. And he does for the theory in particular that Rowland and David construct, which is a four-dimensional avatar of Wessumino-Witten, of course, with some caveats. And so people had studied this line a lot. They had considered many different choices of omega, many different choices of boundary conditions, and in this way have constructed many different two-dimensional integral field theories. Whereas for this whole diamond, there were only two papers, one by David and Rowland and one by a Chinese collaboration. And so we said, okay, why don't we explore all of the choices that have been made for this 4D Chern-Simons theory in this context, in this diamond? In particular, there was a lot known already from 4D Chern-Simons, which we could immediately use to construct now four-dimensional theories in R4. So this is what we did, or this is what we started doing, at least, in integrable deformations from twister space. So this work was done in collaboration with Lewis Cole, Ryan Cullinan, Ben Hoare, and Dan Thompson, and myself. And the idea of what remains of the talk is to schematically describe what we did in this paper. And in particular, I will focus specifically on this here, which is the compactification procedure, which is analogous to the compactification procedure done in Chern-Simons theory. So I never remember what's the phrase in English. In Spanish, we have a phrase which is something like killing two birds with a stone, and the same with a stone, with one stone. And so by analyzing this line, I will almost immediately have analyzed this one. And to add a little bit more, one of the reasons I am here is because we're working with Hank on a very similar idea, but instead of having Chern-Simons theory, we are working with a higher version of Chern-Simons theory. And we have also introduced disordered defects, and we have compactified, and it also works. So I will mainly focus on this line because I really love this procedure, and hopefully you appreciate it as well. Okay, so I will start with the action. Which is an action over twister space. I will focus on Euclidean twister space, which is diffeomorphic to CP1 times R4. And well, this requires, in particular, a choice of omega, which until now, except for this example, I have not specifically stated which one it was. And the one we chose is the following. So for people who have not worked with twistors or is not used to this notation here, this is a 3-0 form on twister space. Namely, it has legs only along the holomorphic direction. And these guys here are poles on CP1. So this pi alpha Langel-Rangel is like z minus alpha on the CP1. So this one I want to leave. This one, OK. I'll go back here. I'll do a drawing there anyways. So basically this choice of 3-0 form says I have two simple poles, one at alpha tilde, a double pole at beta. So first thing we do is we vary our action.
Sorry, just your conventions for the coordinate. It's pi and people have different notations.
Yes, sorry. So pi is a coordinate, CP1 coordinate. I will use undotted indices for pi. Then we have mu a dot, which is the coordinate after imposing the incidence relations of the R4.
Pi is lambda.
Pi is lambda. Pi is lambda.
Pi
and, yes. Some people use pi as I use mu. People use pi in the way I use mu.
No.
Okay. Yeah. So that's true. People usually use lambda instead of pi. So.
I know.
Except for Kevin, who doesn't use that. Indeed.
I think that's okay.
Yes.
So you say that Euclidean twister space is diffeomorphic to CP1 times R4.
Yeah.
When you say that, you're assuming R4 is equipped with the standard smooth structure, right? Like the half stuff.
Yes. Yes.
What if I tune? Like, I don't think you're using the complex structure as much. Right?
So complex structures are very subtle, and I specifically use the word diffeomorphic because they're not as holomorphic, as complex manifolds entirely. They are not, because the complex structures in twister space are subtle. I was on purpose ignoring it so as not to go into that direction. But in particular, you can for each point on CP1, you have a complex structure on R4, and so depending on the point of CP1 is the complex structure you will have on R4. So, first thing we do, we vary our action, and so this will give us a bulk term, which will be the equations of motion. But given that now we have omega, and omega has poles, this will give a boundary term. So if omega didn't have poles, then this would be zero, and therefore everything would be fine. But now we have an anti-holomorphic derivative operator acting on an object which has poles. And del bar of a pole on the holomorphic coordinate gives, schematically, delta functions along the CP1 at the location of the poles. So some coefficient. Sorry?
Well, why do you say delta C be 1? I mean, it's in the location of the problem, it's co-dimension 1.
Ah, yes, okay. So you would put here C2? That's what you mean?
If that was what your notation meant. Like
ah, yes, yes, this is a delta. Yeah.
It's a point on C2. It's a point at C2.
Yeah. So another one at the other pole, and since we have a double pole at beta, a del bar d not bar operator will appear for the pole at beta. What this means is that here we have CP1 times R4. So when we integrate along CP1, these deltas will evaluate these guys at the locations of the pole, meaning that we get a boundary variation of the form some coefficient here. Some other coefficient here, and a third one with this d not.
Yeah, it should be d not r.
Yes, thank you.
That's really just d minus n, right?
Yeah. Thanks. At beta. So if we want delta s to be 0 on shell, we have to impose boundary conditions on the fields at the locations of the poles, which we will do. And they have to be such that when we impose them, these terms vanish. So for example, we'll start at beta, and at beta, we will require that the field is simply 0. This is like a Dirichlet boundary condition. And in particular, we'll also restrict to variations which vanish at beta. And therefore, with this, we have taken care of this term. But now we have these other two terms. And instead of killing each of these independently, what we will do is we will impose boundary conditions such that these terms cancel each other.
So you can't mean that's wrong.
Exactly.
So it's really a CP1
piece. It's really?
It's really a CP1 where I have between these two points together.
Yes.
And it becomes, it's like the singular limit of a lambda curve.
It's the singular?
If I take a genus 1 curve,
yeah.
And then if I send the parameters to the boundary of my space, this is what it becomes. So
it's like the dynamic.
Yeah. And so at alpha and alpha tilde, so here I will use a bit of twister notation to write down this boundary condition. So I will choose a unit norm spinner mu and expand my field in this basis of spinner. For those who are in the pre-talk, this is why I wrote down this expression and insisted that this was going to be important. And the boundary conditions we impose, these are to be thought as the components of a bar in the basis of mu and mu hat. And the conditions we impose are the following. This and a similar one for mu hat. So if one replaces, this looks If one replaces these boundary conditions in this expression here, one sees that this is zero. But let me make a comment. Yes?
So if I get such a boundary condition, you know, alpha, fiber over alpha of the crystal migration is a copy of C2.
Yes.
And the fiber over alpha tilde is a copy of a different C2.
Agree.
And you were choosing an isomorphism between these two bands.
Between the components?
No, between those manifolds. I'm saying.
Ah, okay, okay, yeah.
Say a cage field on this manifold is the same as a cage field on this thermal.
And the problem is a complex structure, you mean?
Yeah, the manifolds are the same as real manifolds, but the identity map from Morph 4 to Morph 4 does not preserve the complex structure. So you need to choose some mapping Morph 4 to Morph 4, which takes one complex structure to the other. Which I assume you've done in notation 7.
So by imposing the conditions on the components instead of on the gauge field.
I mean, the gauge field on the components is the same, but yes.
Okay.
So I suppose I wonder, you could probably do this much more general. I mean, I can take some nonlinear transformation from C2 to itself.
Okay.
Find some other, like if you strip an out of W infinity together.
So more general okay, so one comment to make here about more general things, which I surely believe you can. So let me make one comment in relation to this. So when you choose boundary conditions, or in particular if you choose more general boundary conditions, this will have an effect of the symmetries of your action, right? For instance, In the 4D Chern-Simons case, for this pole structure, people had chosen diagonal boundary conditions. And in particular, this allowed for a gauge symmetry of the 4D action to be there. And the problem we found at the beginning when doing this was precisely because of working on twister space, even if you don't put the sigmas there, the symmetry you find in 4D Chern-Simons is not there anymore. We thought it was a problem for like 3 months, actually, until we realized that you could actually do this, and in particular, potentially consider much more general, not only here, possibly also here, in the case of 4D Chern-Simons. So yeah, it took us a while to actually realize we could do that, in particular because, as I said, the boundary conditions have an effect on the symmetries of the action. In what way? So one gets the six-dimensional action and asks, okay, what are the symmetries now that we have put a boundary, which are the poles. And so one finds that the symmetries of the six-dimensional action will be given by maps that have the form of a gauge transformation, but they are not real gauge transformations, because for them to be symmetries of the action, they have to preserve the boundary conditions. What do I mean with this? For instance, we said that A at beta was zero. So if we want this transformation to be a symmetry of the action, we require that A bar G at beta is equal to zero. And this, killing this, imposes a condition on G at beta. In particular, it imposes a differential condition, and therefore the coordinate dependence of G is now restricted, and that's why it's not formally a gauge transformation anymore. But in particular, when one does the same analysis for the boundary conditions, I'm getting, what do I want to do? No, so I want that guy to be there. Sorry, I'm not used to having so many blackboards. In Argentina, we only have four static ones. If there are four. Sometimes there are only two. Okay, so if someone does a similar analysis for the case of the transformations at alpha and alpha tilde, one finds that G at alpha has to be G at alpha tilde. This is the same constraint one finds in 4D Trensimon theory. But now, due to the fact that we have this guy over here, that, remember, this is pi a d a dot, this operator depends on the CP1 coordinate. And so this condition, even if this parameter wasn't there, is not enough for these transformations to be symmetries. But instead, even for the diagonal case, we have further differential constraints, which are using that expression for the boundary conditions. So originally, we would have that if we pick this, this as alpha is this at alpha tilde, and that's a similar, so here there is a sigma. Similarly for mu hat, but now given that this d bar depends on pi, if we evaluate at alpha, we now have alpha tilde . The thing to look at this, even if the notation confuses, is that now that we're working on twister space, the fact that the del bar operator depends on pi makes that this constraint disappears as an additional constraint than in the case of 4D Trensimons. This means that we will have less symmetries than in the case of 4D Trensimons, and this will have, as we will see in a bit, consequences. So now comes the fun part, which is to actually do this line.
I was always, in the 4D case, I never really liked this perspective. I thought it was much better to think about fixed charges, because when you look at the quantum theory, that's much better than
that. Which one?
Conserved charges,
yeah.
Which in 4D just some poles and lines. And there you can say, well, we think it's kind of tricky. You can say, well, the spectral parameter has this feature that want to go to this point is the same. So it really gives on this little curve. So I would have a similar conserved charges here, right? And you could get 0.1 over copies of C.
Mm-hmm.
Would be a nicer language.
Yes, so it's true there are like very two different languages. One is the one you use, and the other one is the one I learned. and yes, the truth is that for a long time, we thought this was actually a problem, and we said, well, maybe if we write it in language of Wilson lines, this helps. But no one in the collaboration had worked before specifically using that way of thinking of it, and we didn't got there. But it would certainly be interesting to frame it in that language, especially because of the quantum analysis. Okay, so compactification. How do we get the four-dimensional theory? I've talked about 6D, boundary conditions, constraints on the transformations. So now let's get a 4D theory. So for doing this is, again, the way I understand it. I introduce two new fields. Which I call H hat and A prime. So this looks like a gauge transformation, but again, for these transformations to be symmetries of the action, they have to respect the boundary conditions, and we will not require this h hat to respect the boundary conditions. So in principle, this is all to say that a bar and a prime are not gauge equivalent or equivalent. And why do we do this? Because now the idea is that we will write our action. We can write our action by simply replacing these fields here, and we get some coefficient. So this is the expression of how Trans-Simons theory transforms under a gauge transformation. But what we see here is that we have, I have done some operations secretly, but we have this bi term, which is fine, written in terms of a prime. But now we have del bar omega here, and del bar omega here, and del bar omega will give me a delta, and this delta will localize this term to a four-dimensional theory, this term to a four-dimensional theory, and we'll see what we do with this guy. So that will be the idea. Now, in this expression, we have written a bar in terms of two fields, a prime and a hat. So there certainly is...
So confused with the last term. H minus 1 dh cubed, so it's a three-form.
Correct. So I have done a slight little trick in which I have taken an extension, a smooth extension for h, and then extended this by putting a d outside, and then this saturates the holomorphic legs are saturated, and then so when I act. So this is closed. Sorry.
So when you localize that, becomes a five.
Yeah. Exactly. So. As I was saying, there is a lot of redundancy. I'm writing one field in terms of two fields. This actually can be seen in the way that I can transform a prime by some u and simultaneously transform h hat by u, and doing these two transformations at the same time on a prime and h hat leave a invariant. So this is a way we can understand the redundancy in this reparametrization of a bar in terms of h hat and a prime. And in particular, we can use this redundancy to fix degrees of freedom of a prime and h hat conveniently. First thing we do is we kill the CP1 leg of a prime. We're already thinking that a prime will be our four-dimensional connection on the R4, our anti-self dual Yang-Mills connection. So we start by killing the zero component of a prime. But there, even after doing this, we still have some symmetry remaining. For instance, we can perform another of these transformations by a CP1 independent U. And so this term will die, and this term will be preserved. And we can use this additional symmetry to fix the value of h hat at one of the poles. Remember that after localizing, what we will actually care about is the value of h hat at the poles. So we will use this remaining symmetry to fix the value of h hat at beta to zero. OK, so now we have. Why go here. Oh, of this guy here. So now we're almost there. We only have to get rid of the first term. And to get rid of the first term, we will compute the bulk equations of motion of this guy. And the bulk equations of motion, one of the bulk equations of motion is, sorry. So one thing to add is, since I killed the zero component, this dies with a form argument. And so the 0a prime equation of motion is this. And by partially going on shell, meaning if we impose this condition here, the first term vanishes. And then we get our 4D theory. I'm writing 4D because I will integrate along CP1 to localize at each of the poles, or compactify at each of the poles. So this will give me, on R4, at alpha, then the other term will give me a Wessumino term for at alpha. There are some coefficients which I'm ignoring. In particular, the coefficient between these guys are the same, but there is a minus sign, and this gives me a prime a hat h d bar h hat inverse at alpha tilde, and minus a Wessumino term for h hat at alpha tilde. In particular, the beta term dies because I have chosen h hat at beta to be the identity. So whenever I hit h hat at beta with a derivative operator both here and here, it disappears. And so the only thing I get is the localization at alpha and at alpha tilde. So we're almost there because we still have a prime, and we would like these theories to look as 4D theories with no a prime, only h and eventually h tilde. So for convenience, I will call h hat at alpha h and h hat at alpha tilde h tilde. And so the last thing to do in this process is to solve a prime in terms of h and h tilde. And we do this, I will not go into the details of this, but we will do this both using this equation here and the boundary conditions. Because the boundary conditions, remember, were on A, not on A prime. And we have A written in terms of H and A prime. So for example, the boundary condition at beta says that H hat inverse A prime H hat plus H hat inverse D bar H hat beta equals to zero. This is A. And well, h hat at beta is zero, is the identity. So this is zero. And so we find a prime at beta is equal to zero. And similarly, we can use the other two boundary conditions. Those boundary conditions there to completely solve for a prime as a function of h and h tilde. Once we have done that, we replace that expression here and here, and we find this. Which, as it is, especially because it was written before, doesn't say too much, so let me I don't know the word in English, but, you know. say what some of these things are. So we have J and J hat. So J is something like a left Moore Cartan form for the field H. J tilde is the same for the field H tilde. And so we find that we have an, so this is J, J hat. So the hat is related to the fact that we are expressing our we're writing our stuff in the basis mu hat. And so this is a term that couples H with H with H. This term couples H tilde with H tilde. And here we have coupling terms between H and H tilde and H and H tilde. And there is this operator. So this is an action over R4. We have the Wasomino term. And there is this operator here, U plus minus, which is very, very similar to the operator appearing in what's known as the lambda deformation of the Wasomino-Witten 2 model. So in the lambda deformation, you only have one field. So the operator that appears is exactly this. And so in other words, this is a sort of two-field generalization of the lambda deformation of the four-dimensional Wasomino-Witten model. Yes?
In the equation for U plus minus, there is a sigma plus minus, not sigma.
Sigma is the guy, this one. And, well, so this is the action we constructed in our paper. In particular, we also, we also completed the diamond. So
sigma is that thing becoming the spectral parameter? Or no?
No. Sigma is like the deformation parameter.
The spectral parameter is like J is a one form, but you can write it as a 0-1 form. Many different ways depending on the choice of component structure. So the spectral parameter is the choice of component structure.
Thanks. Yeah, so sigma is the deformation parameter. So one thing to say about the theory, which is as expected, because this is by construction, is that the equations of motion of this action here are indeed equivalent to anti-self-dual Young-Mills equations for the connection which I didn't write, but the connection one can construct in terms of the fields. This is by construction. I'll write here. And well, we also filled this diamond. So I have described, as I said, this part of the diamond, but we've also performed symmetry reduction to find a 2D theory, and the same symmetry reduction to analyze 4D Trans-Simon theory. And we constructed the whole diamond, and in particular, what we obtained here was, again, a two-field generalization of this model, of the lambda deformation in two dimensions. Notably, in two dimensions, people know a one-field deformation of the lambda deformation. Not necessarily, you don't need two. So the reason why we actually need two in the case of twister space is related to this additional constraint here, because this, as I said, further constrains the symmetry one has, and which in the two-dimensional case, you don't have that constraint, and so you can use the symmetry to kill H tilde, which you can't do in twister space. And in particular, not only you can't, the presence of H tilde is crucial for this. So that was also another thing we realized in we were looking for a way to kill H tilde, and then when we started doing computations of the anti-self-dual Young-Mills equations, we realized we actually needed H tilde. But in particular, you can also consider two field deformations of the Wasserman-Witten model in 2D. And people had already considered very recently this kind of deformations, but not from the 4D Chern-Simons perspective, in particular because this breaking of adding this parameter here precisely breaks the symmetry, and people, well, didn't want to break the symmetry, so people hadn't considered, in the case of 4D Chern-Simons theory, boundary conditions which broke the symmetry. We found out that in the case of twister space, there is no way around it, and then we said, oh, but what happens if we also do it in 4D Chern-Simons? What happens if we also break that symmetry? Well, the price you have to pay is that you have an extra field, because you cannot fix it, but, well, it's absolutely legal, and in particular, for our happiness, people had already studied those models with two fields. So this is what we've done. So let me close with some short remarks. So the idea of this talk was to try and argue that if someone asks and says, I want to study integrability, this is a great thing to do, because not only you can construct a bunch of integrable models, there are many things which were hidden, their origin, like where do the Lax connection comes, where do anti-Celsius Young-Mills connection comes. And this gives you an argument. I don't know if this is the, you know, God's word, but it's definitely a stronger argument that, well, I found it and it works. And a very nice argument indeed. So that first, want to study classical integrability. This is a good way to go, but also, as I said, in 2021, well, actually people here are studying quantum integrability using these things. And, well, one thing to add is that this 6D Chern-Simons theory, at least at the classical level still, there are still a bunch of things you can try, you can do, by simply getting ideas from 4D Chern-Simons, as we did, and adding ideas as the one Kevin suggested. So this is still a terrain where a lot of things can be done, with the possibility of then doing quantization. And in that sense, with the same group, we did this paper. We are working on a paper that hopefully will soon be out, in which we construct a gauged Wasserman-Witten 4 models. So to do this, there is a slight addition that you have to do. It's not enough to consider a 6D Chern-Simons action. Instead, you have to consider two fields. And a coupling term. Between these two fields. A and B gauge fields. Non-abelian gauge fields. I cannot see it that fast. Yeah, it's a boundary term. The very broadly, the idea is gauged Wasserman-Witten models can usually be thought as a difference of two Wasserman-Witten models. So you would obtain a Wasserman-Witten model from here, using what David and Roland did, that choice of omega, a Wasserman-Witten model from here. But there is a condition that in two dimensions happens automatically, related to some self-duality of the field, the gauge field you are using to gauge, which in four dimensions that doesn't happen automatically. And this this term takes care of that and imposes that condition as a like Lagrange multiplier idea. Bueno, that's it. Thank you very, very much.
Any questions?
Yes, please.
So I guess what originally basically was really looking at this picture was that Moore did a long time ago projection that all integral models symmetry reductions into subtree and transformations. And of course when Moore conjectured that, I don't think the lambda model existed, the lambda deformation. So can I understand this as saying that the equations of motion of the lambda deformation do arise as a symmetry reduction of the subtree in those equations, or is it not quite so easy to see that?
It's possible to get the one field lambda deformation by tuning the parameters along which you symmetry reduce. So in particular, yeah, for a very specific choice of parameters, you. When going here to AFT2, you enhance the symmetry that you had broken above. And so, from the anti-Sajua Young-Mills equations, you can get the by symmetry reducing.
I guess maybe the question is, if can I gauge fix the anti-Sajua equations to get the mass?
So that's a very interesting question, which we actually explored and asked ourselves, and we have not come to a concrete.
I think it's tell, right? Because you're considering bundles and then nodes, so they're required to have the same value as two different points. Whereas the Sajua-Young-Mills equation here does not have that constraint. So it's not every solution of Sajua-Young-Mills equation has the same thing at these two points, right?
Which we didn't do, and so I don't know. But it was actually a question that we analyzed, the same exact question that you have asked, and we didn't come to a conclusive answer.
Now, a question that we need to ask. You drew three cores there, where you could have take a degenerate situation where you have two cores, mm-hmm. and then you would get a single field.
Correct. That's what Roland and David did. Indeed.
Okay. So you would get it from the subtree. That would answer all questions.
Well,
but
in Swissor space, to get the tuples, you have to kind of merge the one of the alpha to of the other alpha tilde and merge it.
Yeah. So then you only end up with one
alpha. That is correct. And
so then, don't you get the lambda deformation?
No, you just get the principal karma.
But there's two tuples, one with this double, or triple, single. So if you do the single triple,
yeah, I don't know
why. If you do the single triple.
Single triple, it looks like the alpha would be untouched.
I think about the single triple is that when you start playing around, you have to be careful also with the boundary conditions.
Sure, but your boundary condition, it would be more lax at that. What you did is you had d0 at a bar equals 0, and you just input a bar equals 0, which is stronger than what you need to do.
Yeah. For a double pole?
Yeah, the same thing for triple. For triple pole, you would get d square, you would get d bar square.
At higher order poles, you find this derivative gauge fields, provide further fields, okay. So you get actually many fields. So you might find them here.
So. The thing, when you start increasing the order of the poles, where is it? So d bar omega, also starts, you start increasing the, this and so this includes higher order derivatives of the gauge field.
Sure, but inside the condition was that whatever appears inside was zero.
Of the gauge field at the pole, you mean? Yes, but that's not enough to, for example, kill this guy. If you have, say, this, because there will be terms that will have a derivative acting here and a derivative acting here, and you've only killed the field, not the derivative.
I think you're watching the gate. It's like field vanishes half of the components of the observer.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So that's effectively the range, right? It's half of the components vanish.
Especially if you have a three order. If you have fourth order pole, you impose that A and its derivative is zero.
Yeah,
for sure.
I mean, okay.
There is an additional parameter which I didn't speak about, which is the direction along which you symmetry reduce, right?
Just the right way.
Yeah. If you don't have sigma and you align the symmetry reduction in a nice way, you get the enhanced symmetry, which allows you to fix H tilde to identity and get the lambda, the one field lambda model.
I feel that's not a limit of this
then. That's not A?
That's not a limit of this model. I mean, obviously, because
then
it's a different spectrum.
In what sense you think it's not a limit?
I have a theory with two scalar fields.
Yeah.
I can't just change it to become a theory with one scalar field.
Okay.
is it not possible to change it to
sort of the equations of motion that have some basic grounds? You can change it to be a product of two things.
Right.
Lambda.
But let me see if I understand. You have a theory with two scalar fields in 2D.
Yes.
And you analyze that theory and you find that it has symmetry.
Yes, but it's not gauge theory. Yeah. When you give me my theory,
yeah.
That's about the gauge theory.
True. Yeah. And so you say that it's not legal to use that symmetry to kill one of the fields.
No. Unless you gauge it.
Unless you gauge it,
yeah.
Yeah,
of course.
So I don't know too much, but have you ever looked at the relation of this and the work of Sylvain Lacroix about the Lipkin models? I wonder if this is a degenerate limit of his Lipkin models.
In 4D transignments, you mean?
Yeah.
No. Anders?
Yeah, that's right.
So the because there are two papers we looked at when we were doing this. One of the papers is the one which in which they construct this two-field lambda deformation. And then the other paper, which was much more recent than that one, which I think is the one you are making reference to, is in which they consider higher genus. We haven't. So if it's with the most recent paper, we haven't looked at it and analyzed in this context. But you think it would be worth doing?
Yeah.
Why would you think it's related?
Oh, because if I take a Lipkin model and I send Q to zero, you get a model in CP1 where I've identified two points. Because I'm shrinking a side point on the curve. This is what happens. You know, like all of the Lipkin models.
I see. Okay.
And conversely, you can have it again with the model. Instead of just identifying here and here, you do some complicated coordinate transformation, or coordinate here times coordinate here. And then you fix the singularity in the
To get the other ones.
To go that's deformation of things. Like
okay.
Very complicated things.
Yeah, nice. We'll definitely look at that.
lots of things to do.
Yeah.
So let's thank Martin again.